My name is Peter Nash. I am the chair of biblical studies at Garrett Evangelical Theological Seminary in Evanston, Illinois, which is not a Lutheran seminary, but I think that's okay. I teach Hebrew and Old Testament, and I think I mentioned this is my third time out here at Holden doing Bible studies. So it's fun to be here. And we're going to talk today about 1 Samuel 1 and just a little bit of 1 Samuel 2. And for the next 10 days, we'll be talking about 1 Samuel. I'm currently working on a United Methodist adult curriculum section on 1 and 2 Samuel. So. But this is my first time going through this in public, so lucky you. I think 1 Samuel is, in the scheme of the Hebrew Bible, the transition from what we often call charismatic leadership, temporary leadership for a specific purpose, which then reverts, the power leaves the person and reverts to the community. We see that in Moses and Joshua, and then very clearly in the book of Judges, where judges rise for a moment as they're presented for a moment in history, and then fulfill the task, rescue, basically, deliver Israel. Then there's peace in the land for a certain number of years, and then at the next crisis, not their son or daughter, but someone else rises and takes the leadership. Someone more geographically or politically connected to the crisis at hand takes leadership. But with Samuel, we see the transition from this charismatic leadership to dynastic leadership. In the 8th chapter of Samuel, which we'll look at later this week, the people actually ask God to step aside from being king and give them a king like the other nations. And Samuel is not at all pleased with this because Samuel is actually acting as king. Samuel, in the early part of 1 Samuel 8, attempts to appoint his sons as judges over Israel. So he's a real transitional, pivotal character from this charismatic leadership where one rises up and acts as judge for a period, and then the leadership moves to another part of the country, to first Saul, who did actually no better than Samuel. He's the first one called a king, but his son-in-law becomes the king, but that seems to be an accident. And then David becomes the king of Israel, and is really, according to the tradition, only in David do we have a king, a dynasty. There's only one dynasty for Judah, from David to the exile. The northern kingdom Israel is a little different. Actually, it's very different. There are a series of dynasties in the north, but as the story is told to us, the northern kingdom needs not to be remembered anyway, and in fact is sent off into virtual oblivion in 721, until of course they show up in Utah, or upstate New York, move to Illinois, and then to Utah as the Mormons, or any of the other groups that claim to be part of the lost 10 tribes of Israel. But the nation of Judah, the southern kingdom, has one dynasty. Every king claims to be a descendant of David, who is, at least by some standards, the ideal king. But what we're interested in these 2 weeks, in these sessions during these 2 weeks, is the book of Samuel, 1 Samuel, where we see part of this transition taking place. As the note outside about me says, if any of you happen to read that, I'm very interested in power issues in the Hebrew Bible, and family relationships in the Hebrew Bible. And we're going to see some of each of those as we look at the book of 1 Samuel. Starting right off today with the story that leads up to the birth of Samuel. So let's open our Bibles to 1 Samuel 1, and we'll see a power struggle within a family, and I end up at the very beginning a very happy man today. Just my kind of story. 1 Samuel 1, 1 through 8, if you take a look at those, if someone gets there first and feels comfortable reading for us, if you'd do that, please.
First verse is fairly daunting.
Oh, there, yeah. All those names. Well, no one knows how to say them anyway, unless they live in Israel.
I'll read from the Serendipity Bible.
Great.
There was a certain man from Mount Saint, Zuthite from the hill country of Ephraim, whose name was Elkanah, son of Jeroham, the son of Elihu, the son of Tohu, the son of Zuth, an Ephraimite. He had two wives, one called Hannah and the other Peninnah. Peninnah had children, but Hannah had none. Year after year, this man went up from his town to worship and sacrifice to the Lord Almighty at Shiloh, where Hophni and Phinehas, the two sons of Eli, were priests of the Lord. Whenever the day came for Elkanah to sacrifice, he would give portions of the meat to his wife Peninnah and to all her sons and daughters. But to Hannah he gave a double portion because he loved her, and the Lord had closed her womb. And because the Lord had closed her womb, her rival kept provoking her in order to irritate her. This went on year after year. Whenever Hannah went up to the house of the Lord, her rival provoked her till she wept and would not eat. Elkanah, her husband, would say to her, "Hannah, why are you weeping? Why don't you eat? Why are you downhearted? Don't I mean more to you than 10 sons?"
Thank you for your courage and for your fine reading. Those who were here for the first Bible study saw my son and daughter and saw some of this family rivalry worked out in their very presence. It didn't intend it to be an object lesson, but it was. What do you see here in terms of the first eight verses here are a piece of what we, in narrative analysis, we call just background material. We're going to tell you who this family is. And then the next nine verses will also give us a piece of background material about the priesthood. We've seen one piece of it here, it slipped in. But then the next piece starts up with some background material about the priesthood and what state it is in. A little bit of foreshadowing for what will come up in chapter 3. So as you look at this family as it's described, what do you see?
Human beings.
First thing to note about biblical characters is they are human beings, and they're just as nasty as we, as good as we are.
You were right the first time.
What do you want to see some more about?
There's cruelty. There's longing, there's desire, there's mourning, there's sadness, there's, you know, all of the human emotions are represented. Mm-hmm. And it really cuts to the very core, too, this particular story of who women are, mm-hmm. and what we do.
Okay. Yes?
If we knew where these places were, or if the names of any of this family tree meant anything to us, would that tell us something about the family that we don't know by just looking?
Not very much. Ephraim tells you that this is one of this is from the tribe of one of the sons of Joseph, but not much else. I don't know of anything about any of Elkanah's forebears. I think we could go to the any of the Bible dictionaries, and they would probably just say 1 Samuel 1 and Ephraim, and that's about it. None of these show up anywhere else that I know of.
I have a logistical question before we go much further into the other stuff. When she was reading it, it said something about a double portion, mm-hmm. And my translation says only one portion, and that's a different dynamic, really. I
mean, yeah. It's one of those words that we just don't know how to translate. It shows up, I think, only twice in the Hebrew Bible here, and I think when Elijah is taken up and Elisha gets a double portion of his spirit, mm-hmm. and some translations say a double portion and some translations say a full portion, and we're not sure what this particular word means, and so even when the Greeks translated it from the Hebrew, they weren't sure, and that's where we get the two different very clear readings, which is something to remember. about any time you read the Bible, it's always someone's interpretation or someone's plural in a group of people who have put things together. I look in the back and see on the stack that there's at least one copy of the Living Bible, which is one person's paraphrase. And I carry on with my first Hebrew professor's tradition of saying that's a demonic piece. Because it's one person's idea rather than several people working together and coming to an agreement as to what we might read. Yes, sir?
Who's her rival? I don't understand what that is. Is that another daughter?
No, it's another wife. Yeah, a little different back then. And let me just say a word about that. And I've always assumed that this meant that Hannah was the first wife, although now that I read the text carefully, it's not clearly stated in the text. But usually one in a polygamous culture, Semitic culture, would have the option of marrying as many wives. Well, in Islamic culture, I think it's four is the maximum, but as many as one could afford to support. But one would normally have children from the first wife before going on to take on another wife, unless she was unable to bear children. So this taunting that goes on here seems to be reflective of Hagar and Sarah. That Sarah feels taunted by Hagar because she has a child. And then later it's threatened that that child being firstborn will displace her child, which she regards as the legitimate heir. So there seems to be some reflecting back to that piece.
That was more or less what I was going to say. If we came to this passage cold, we would see that conflict within the family. But since we know about Sarah and Hagar, and we know about Rachel and Leah, we're set up to know that somehow when this story is told, where there is one wife who is childless but beloved, and another who has children and is holding out against that first one, then something is going to happen in the story to overturn those relationships.
As soon as you hear a woman is barren in the Bible, with the exception of David's wife Michael, you know that she's going to have a baby in the next chapter or two, or in the Hebrew Bible. You can be sure that there will be a baby boy coming soon. And thank you. Rachel and Leah are an example. Sarah and Hagar are another example from Genesis. And Rebecca as well. Or Rachel. Right? Rebecca is also noted as barren, but there's simply a prayer there. There's not a rival in that case. And then we don't know her name, so I've referred to her in my notes as Mrs. Manoah. Samson's wife, Samson's mother in Judges 15, I think it is barren, and there's a prayer, and then I don't know if her prayer was answered or not, because Samson seemed like the kind of teenage son no mother would want, or father for that matter, especially if he asked for the car keys. So we've got clearly competition, rivalry between, and that she's referred to as the rival wife, between Hannah and Peninnah. Do you see any other competition here in this text? What do you make of Elkanah's word of comfort to his wife? You thought he was enough. More than enough. Since very few of us want 10 sons these days. Any women want to comment on that? Or we just let that sit on its own. Joseph Sittler, who was a Lutheran theologian in Chicago, when he talked about this passage, would say that Peninnah understood but didn't care, and Elkanah cared but didn't understand, which is, I think, as succinct a description of this piece as I've ever heard. Peninnah knew exactly what was going on, and she was going to exploit it because she was threatened by Hannah, and trying to gain the upper hand. Elkanah cared a great deal, but simply couldn't understand what it meant not to be able to produce something that's very important to you to produce. And in this case, it's clear. Children, he's already had children, so he doesn't know what it's like not to be able to do that. But it doesn't have to be children. It could be, a piece of work at work. It could be something else around the household. Jennifer Berman, have you ever seen that T-shirt or postcard? It's got an auditorium full of seats with only two people in it, and it's the heading is the National Gathering of the Adult Children of Normal Parents. that's Jennifer Berman, and she has a whole series of these things, and one of them is a dog and a cat lying in bed together, and the cat is saying, "I'm not being aloof, I'm a blankety blank cat." And the caption is, "Think of your mate as a cross-cultural experience." after years of being a 60s wannabe, I have finally come to the conclusion there are some things that men just can't understand about women, and women just can't understand about men, and that every individual can't, and ultimately in some ways each of us is an individual and stands alone, and we have to make the connections where we can make the connections. And this piece of Elkanah trying so desperately to comfort his wife with words that must have fallen like lead on her ears, am I not more than 10 sons to you, is really striking to me in that way. That in this, as we know now, temporary barrenness, she is absolutely alone. And even someone who cares a great deal about her can't get through. And I think that might be a good word for us to remember, like Job's friends should have remembered, when we go to comfort those who grieve, that there's always more to the situation than we can understand, and offer what we can, but understand that it might not be the right thing. And that's a risk that we take whenever we reach out and whenever we allow people to reach into us. Yes.
There's an old social work expression that comes to mind. Beware, help me strike at any time.
Yeah. I'm from Washington. We're here to help. You're hearing that all over the Midwest right now. Only temporarily comforted by it. Let's go on to 9 through 18. Someone would read that section for us.
So Hannah rose up after they had eaten in Shiloh and after they had drunk. Now Eli the priest sat upon a seat by a post of the temple of the Lord. And she was in bitterness of soul and prayed unto the Lord and wept sore. And she vowed a vow and said, O Lord of hosts, if thou wilt indeed look on the affliction of thine handmaid and remember me, and not forget thine handmaid, but will give unto thine handmaid a man-child, then I will give him unto the Lord all the days of his life, and there shall no razor come upon his head. And it came to pass, as she continued praying before the Lord, that Eli marked her mouth. Now Hannah, she spoke in her heart, only her lips moved, but her voice was not heard. Therefore Eli thought she had been drunken. And Eli said unto her, How long wilt thou be drunken? Put away thy wine from thee. And Hannah answered and said, No, my lord, I am a woman of a sorrowful spirit. I have drunk neither wine nor strong drink, but have poured out my soul before the Lord. Count not thy handmaid for a daughter of Belial, for out of the abundance of my complaint and grief have I spoken hitherto. Then Eli answered and said, Go in peace, and the God of Israel grant thee thy petition that thou hast asked of him. And she said, Let thine handmaid find grace in thy sight. So the woman went her way and did eat, and her countenance was no more sad.
Thank you. Is that the King James that you want?
I think so.
Sure does. That daughter of Belial is a worthless woman. It's apparently a word that they didn't know how to translate in the early 17th century, which of course we know how to translate now. And it'll come up again in chapter two, when Eli's sons are described as sons of worthlessness. It comes up in Genesis and the description of the men of Sodom who want to meet the angels who come to visit Lot. So we know that whatever it is, it's pretty bad. Worthless characters, it's usually translated now. I said before that I think of this piece as a sort of a description or a piece of foreshadowing about the state of the priesthood at this point. I say foreshadowing because it will become very clear in chapter 3 and chapter 4 that Eli, who is charged at this major sanctuary in Israel with the care of the worship of God, doesn't perceive things clearly. In chapter 3, we'll see a reference that the word of the Lord was rare in Israel in those days. Here, there's a woman whom we know to be in bitter despair, going to the proper place to pour out her heart, and the high priest doesn't recognize that. He thinks she's a drunken, homeless vagabond. What kind of a person is that to be in church? Right? We should all be in church with our suits on and with our happy faces on. He's unable to recognize her state. Maybe it's just a guy thing. Maybe we just don't get it, as Feinstein and Braun and Barbara Boxer would have us be reminded. But I think it's a statement about the state of the priesthood. The sons, we noted, are worthless. Eli is virtually blind when Samuel takes over in chapter 3. When Samuel is called in chapter 3, three times he goes into the high priest and says, "You called me." There's this Samuel, Samuel. He wakes up, he runs to the one who should be calling him, he thinks. He says, "No, I didn't call you." He takes the high priest, sort of the direct link to God, as the form would have us see, three times to figure out that maybe in the temple God is calling someone. What a surprise. So here in chapter 1, Hannah comes in and prays, makes her request, and because the form doesn't fit, he can't see a legitimate prayer. And I think that's the piece of foreshadowing, the statement about where the priesthood is. The high priest can't recognize a legitimate prayer. When she points out to them that she's, you know, don't make me out to be a daughter of worthlessness, a worthless woman. Rebukes his rebuke. Then he comes across with what I call a fairly typical pastoral response in a difficult situation: peace. And may God give you what you ask. And this may God give you what you ask becomes important when the child is named. It comes from this Hebrew root here, and the transliteration is sha'al, to ask, to request. It also means to lend. And we'll talk about that at probably near the end of the hour here. And then she has a fairly polite response to him. May your handmaiden find favor in the eyes of the Lord, and so on. And she went And as the text tells us, she had, you know, there was something transformative about this trip to the sanctuary. She had refused to go. In her distress, apparently, although it may have been a preparation for this trip to the sanctuary, it may have been fasting, but as the text tells it, what do the shrinks call it? Reactive depression. Once again, she's confronted with barrenness, and she's depressed to the point that she doesn't eat, she doesn't drink, she doesn't sleep well. She goes to the sanctuary, and something changes here, because when she leaves, her face is no longer, this is another one of those places where we don't know how to translate it. Actually, there's a word inserted in the Greek that's not there in the Hebrew. It just says her face was no more. And then the Greeks have the word long or sad. But something has changed, and she's able to eat and drink again. And then we'll see that she goes back on down to Rama. And in this case, just an aside, down means, anytime you go to a sanctuary, you go up, as in Jerusalem. And when you leave the sanctuary, you go down. Usually they were built in high places, which you'll hear lots of negative things about when you read the prophets. Yes?
Would it have been unusual for her to go to the temple as a woman to pray as she did?
There were probably at this point not the kinds of distinctions that you'll see during the Jerusalem temple period. Those things seem to come as the religion is more formalized. In the early periods, there's not the kind of problem, they're not the kind of distinctions. She probably went to normally would have gone to a separate part, but that's not even clear to me. But it's as things get more formalized in Jerusalem, that women are more systematically excluded. One of my colleagues has done a lot of work on women's parallel religions and parallel structures in the ancient Near East. And her name is Phyllis Bird. If I understand her correctly, she suggests that it's in part this access that women have in the outlying sanctuaries that makes them so troublesome for the official cult in Jerusalem. That's one of the things that they want to get the women under control in some ways. Just want to note here in verse 11, the prayer is almost formulaic. If you really see the affliction of then remember me, forget me not, give your servant the seed of man. I will give him to you all the days of his life, and a razor shall never go up on his head. The way she prays is very interesting, because it seems so unchristian. Geez, God, if you're really listening, if you're really out there, was not at all problematic for the Hebraic mind. If you read the Psalms, you get all kinds of challenges like this. If you read Job, it's very clear that this almost adversarial position between the prayer and God, even at a couple points where the prayer says, "If I die, who's going to praise you?" No one praises you from Sheol. The praises can't get up to heaven from there. So there's a very clear intimacy. The way you can only argue with your kids or your spouse or other members of your family. We don't do this kind of stuff except with dear friends or bitter enemies.
Where does the no razor shall touch his head?
This is the Nazirite vow. Samson, another one of these babies born out of baby boys born out of barrenness. Boy, that's alliterative, isn't it? the whole deal about his encounter with Delilah and trying to figure out where his superhuman strength comes from finally lodged in the fact that his hair has never been cut, and as soon as they cut his hair, he's a weakling. He was a Nazarite. Tradition of one particular sect apparently given, dedicated to God at birth, who would never cut their hair, to which Samuel and Samson belong. I don't know if there are any other significant characters. We only mentioned a few other times in Hebrew Bible. Which is an interesting piece. If there's anybody in the Hebrew Bible who must be depicted, it seems, with long hair all throughout his career, it should be Samuel. He should look like kind of a wild man if the vow was kept. Yes?
I'm struck by her self-possession in terms of both kind of extraordinary tenderness in that first passage of her husband, you know, based on a focus on the family that was so directed toward bearing offspring, but, you know, there's a tenderness that he expresses, but she says, you know, that's not enough, and also with regard to the priest, no, wait a minute, you don't get it, you know, she really knows.
Yeah. That's a good point. There's, in my mind, too much of a tendency to talk about the women of the ancient periods, and especially of the Hebrew Bible, as sort of non-entities. Mm-hmm. That they recede. All they do is bear babies and disappear. Mm-hmm. But if you look at the parts that the women play when they do speak up, they are incredibly self-possessed. Hannah being one of them, Sarah. To the point that now womenist theologians call her as much of an oppressor as any male in the Bible, in the way that she had Hagar and Ishmael run out of the house, literally into the desert, to almost what would have, had not been for the intercession of God, certain death. Rachel and Leah, you know, in their kind of struggling over Jacob, which maybe was not the best of choice, but that was the only choice they had. And they're, they are the ones who say, listen, your brothers-in-law, our brothers, are giving you the shaft. Let's grab this stuff and get out of here. And when they leave, it's the wives, Rachel and Leah, who take the family gods and stuff them under the baggage and take off to ensure security in their minds for the family. So the women, when they do speak up, Deborah being another example, when they do speak up, they're incredibly powerful. We just have to remember that for the most part, men controlled which stories got written down from these texts. Another piece that needs to be said about that is they had, if you read Proverbs 31, you usually only hear it about Mother's Day, a woman of valor, who can place a value on her, which ends with, or at least the part my mother quoted all the time, ends with, her children will rise up and call her blessed. And my mother's still waiting. I'm sure I'll come around sooner or later. That text gives women a much greater place in public than we generally acknowledge women in the ancient Near East. And that, in fact, is a piece of international wisdom literature, not a specifically Israelite piece. Place in the marketplace, bargaining with merchants and so on, building a house, assisting in the building of the house, as a full partner in the economic enterprise. And we don't acknowledge that very often. We don't acknowledge that it's even in the text. Sometimes I think for, you know, the hyperbole of argument, but sometimes just because we miss it, because we don't listen to the text on its own terms. So she's not a drunken spectacle. We look at 3 and 4. Let's go on then from 19 to the end of the chapter to 20 to 28.
The next morning, Elkanah and his family got up early, and after worshiping the Lord, they went back home to Ramah. Elkanah had intercourse with his wife Hannah, and the Lord answered her prayer. So it was that she became pregnant and gave birth to a son. She named him Samuel and explained, "I asked the Lord for him." The time came again for Elkanah and his family to go to Shiloh and offer to the Lord the yearly sacrifice and the special sacrifice he had promised. But this time Hannah did not go. She told her husband, "As soon as the child is weaned, I will take him to the house of the Lord where he will stay all his life." Elkanah answered, "All right, do whatever you think best. Stay at home until you have weaned him, and may the Lord make your promise come true." So Hannah stayed at home and nursed her child. After she had weaned him, she took him to Shiloh, taking along a 3-year-old bull, a bushel of flour, and a leather bag full of wine. She took Samuel, young as he was, to the house of the Lord at Shiloh. After they had killed the bull, they took the child to Eli. Hannah said to him, "Excuse me, sir, do you remember me? I am the woman you saw standing here praying to the Lord. I asked him for this child, and he gave me what I asked for. So I am dedicating him to the Lord. As long as he lives, he will belong to the Lord." Then they worshiped the Lord there.
Thanks. What's this special sacrifice that the Elkanah is taking up? This special offering for the vow that he made. When he goes up, he says, it says he's going up for his regular sacrifice as well as the special offering which he had vowed. Where did that come from?
Does it have to do with the birth of your child?
Well, apparently it does. They usually don't tell us much that doesn't have to do with the story. I mean, Hebrew narrative is very sparse. Mm-hmm. But it also tells us that this, what I see in this is that there's stuff going on in the story that we don't know about. Mm-hmm. And they forgot that they didn't tell us this because that, you know, all this time maybe Elkanah was making promises that if Hannah had a child that he would pay an extra tithe or something. Mm-hmm. Which brings him into the whole process as well. This being a prayerful act. I remembered something, then I forgot it again. we need to talk about closing these wombs and the worldview in a minute. Note that this child is absolutely normally conceived here. Yeah. God works through the normal methods. When he is born, then she gives him the name. Another piece of this self-possession. Oddly, it's not clear to me yet, after, 9 years of teaching and 20 years of studying this stuff, who in ancient Israel named the babies. Sometimes the mothers do, sometimes the fathers do. In this case, since we're explaining, it's an etiological name, a name that explains where he came from, we have a little bit of a problem. Over a half dozen times, I still haven't gotten counted up accurately because I keep finding them in different forms, but this verb form, this root comes up, sha'al, to ask. And finally in verse 28 it comes up as Sha'ul, this form here at the bottom. And that, does that look like an English word to anyone? Mm-hmm. Anybody have any friends from college or work named Saul? This is the form that a few chapters later we'll run into this character, Sha'ul, someone who is asked of the Lord. It's a passive participle, which everybody wanted to know, I'm sure. But it is interesting to me, so you have to listen. many people think that since this verb form, this root, shows up so many times, at least six, in this chapter, that this is actually a birth story that was originally attributed to Saul. Because if you have a child who is asked of the Lord, Sha'al, who is promised to the Lord, lent to the Lord, She'el, it's an intensive form of the verb. And then the last mention of it is what he's given back. He was asked of the Lord, and the actual name shows up. Usually that's the person's name, like Yitzhak. She laughed, so the boy's name is Yitzhak, Isaac. That's how etiologies usually work. So when you actually get the name coming up as Shaul, this should be the baby's name, according to many of us. But there arose a problem. We've got this great story. Nobody wants to give up this story. Everybody knows this story, and it's not going to die out. Stories don't die out. Like that Corvette, you know, that someone got for $200 because someone died in it and was in it for several weeks before they found the body. Everybody heard that story. It never dies out. Kids are still telling it in junior high school now. This story was going to stick around. And so let's take it away from this bad guy Saul and give it to a good guy Samuel. There's one argument about this birth story. That we know in some cases that stories move from one character to another, especially in the book of Genesis, as the families got put together, so to speak. It's a linguistic argument, but it's not a very complicated linguistic argument, especially since Shaul looks just like Saul. Most people can understand it in English and most Western languages. Counter argument for that is that and I'm not sure that anybody will believe this, I'll try it out on you. Samuel is in fact a king. We have a problem with the etiology. It should be Shemuel. God has listened, has heard my request, which would be Sha'al, as a counterpoint to who's coming next. But you have to buy first the argument that Samuel is a king rather than a judge, even though he's referred to as a judge. And you heard some of where I go with this. That is, he plays the role of the king. He is he's as successful as a dynastic leader as the first named king is. And in fact, he is the kingmaker. He anoints both of his successors, David and Saul and David. And in 1 Samuel 8, in this dramatic piece where the people of Israel ask God to step aside as their noted king, up until this point, Yahweh has always been the king of Israel. It comes at the point when Samuel is trying to put his two sons, who were ruling down in Beersheba, sort of the outskirts of Israel he's trying to make them be the new judges, the new central judges of Israel, and the people then rise up and say, no, they're not really all that honest, and give us a king like the other nations. So Samuel attempts a dynasty, is not successful at it, but is every bit as successful as Saul, and is in fact the ruler of the whole nation for several decades. Indicates to me that he is in fact functioning as a king. And so maybe this story could stand with him if you buy that argument. So, any questions so far? Or comments about some of this wildness?
The NRSV notation on that comments that Saul also are not only having a reference to asking, but also can mean borrow.
It can be.
And that at least there's the sense that could have play in them to the vow of being lent. And so if that's the case, it could give a regional explanation as to Samuel, apart from the story of a regal birth narrative.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, it could work the other way, as a way in which that story could enter in with connection to the vow.
Yeah.
It seems it can go either way, but apparently the word also permits at least that meaning of being borrowed.
To ask, to lend, to borrow, all our meanings for it. The problem is that with this passive participle, you actually get Saul's name here.
Mm-hmm.
And so...
That's where the clue would come in for the royal narrative.
Right. If you have an etiological tale, usually you end up with the person's actual name or very close to it. And Shemuel, it's not close at all. That's the problem.
And what is the etymology of Samuel?
El, the other one of the names for God, one of the two major names for God in the Hebrew Bible, has heard, and which would be in response to the request, the Sha'al.
So you could make a list. You could insert verbs into this story that would fit the plot that would lead to the name he does get. They're not there, I understand that, but conceivably, they could use a different set of verbs, instructions that would lead to Sam's name.
Well,
it kind of fits with this story, right?
It could, yeah. And as it stands, you've got what seems to be a different etiology, a different explanation of the name, coming in the middle of one long. I mean, this starts in verse 16, comes up twice in 16, and then in or 17, and then comes up again in 19, and comes up again all over the place in 26, 27, 28. But only in this one place is there Shemuel.
Right.
Is there any
right.
reference
I
to?
I understand the problem.
Yeah.
Even Saul, though, seems to be a transition person. He isn't actually what we think of as a king. He's mostly a military leader in that sense. And, you know, pointing towards the real king, which had come.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I have a little trouble with thinking of Samuel becoming a kingly as a kingly character, more of a prophet, at least kind of the last of the prophets.
Yeah.
Do you see Samuel as a transition?
I'd say he's another step in the transition, but he actually gets named as king. He's anointed by the prophet. One of the differences is in Israel, it's only with the establishment of the monarchy that you get a separation of the political and the religious life. You know, so you say he's more of a prophet. Well, Moses was the political leader, he was the military leader, and he was the religious leader. The same with Joshua, the same with each of the judges. And it's the attempt, we see it in Judges 6 through 9 with Gideon, the attempt to put one's son, or the attempt of one's son to come, or heir, to come to the throne, or to come to political, religious, economic leadership, that I can start to talk about a kingship. In my mind, it's the dynasty, or the attempt at a dynasty that makes kingship, not more than the functions, because the functions have all been merged. They only separate once you start to have a dynasty. And then you have Samuel versus Saul, Nathan sort of versus David, and then finally the Elisha and the writing prophets versus any king anywhere. Yeah.
And it strikes me that if we look at that whole period as transition, that you have the pressure between what seemed to emerge in Israel as a very decentralized bond of peoples that occasionally came together in order for self-preservation and defense, and the pressures that exist within any political structure to nail those things down so that we know what's going to happen, that gradually begin to encroach on the charismatic leadership style. And so in that sense, you get Samuel, who is really operating like a judge, but begins to look like a king because we're trying to be more secure. Saul, who is then named as a king, but still operates pretty much as a judge.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not until David that finally the pressure of that dynastic certainty and bureaucratic structure begins to really take hold within the Israelite community. Yeah.
It actually really takes hold under Solomon's reign. As David, as we see,
emerges as a charismatic leader.
He can't hold a thing together.
Yeah.
He can't hold a thing together, but Solomon does. We're out of time. I'm going to start tomorrow with 1 Samuel 2, 1 through 10, try to make some links with the gospel passage from last night, for those of you who were here, and then go on to talk about Samuel's life in the temple and his actual call to ministry. Thanks for your attention.